passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody. It is John Pollock, and joining us, as always, it is Brandon Thurston. Brandon, I thought you were like just hightailing and leaving me here. I just saw the countdown. It was like 10 seconds, and Brandon just ran away. I was like, uh-oh, is he under some kind of seizure that I'm unaware of? There's been a records request that has gone awry that Brandon is in trouble.
I had to go do something real quick to make sure I was not interrupted.
He is here. We are here. We have lots to discuss on today's show because... Well, after several months, we officially got a response from Vince McMahon when it comes to the Janelle Grant lawsuit that was filed all the way back on January the 25th. Quite the week in professional wrestling history that began with a Netflix announcement, featured a lawsuit announcement, and ended with the resignation of Vince McMahon, all in a several-day period. So on
CM Punk even tore his triceps in that period as well.
CM Punk managed to tear his triceps in that period as well. And now we have got a 29-page filing from Vince McMahon's side, and he is being represented by several lawyers. We had already known about Kasowitz Benson Torres, which is the same legal firm that did represent MLW in the recent case against WWE that reached a $20 million settlement. And Vince McMahon has retained the services of Jessica Rosenberg and Jonathan L. Shapiro, while also adding James A. Budenitz of McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter, LLP. A lot of names
happening here. I won't put their phone numbers and their emails on the screen right now, but I'm looking at that portion of the complaint. I think what's happening there is Mr. Budenitz is his office is in Connecticut, and this is being litigated in Connecticut federal court. So there's pro hac vice pending for Jessica Rosenberg and Jonathan Shapiro, who are probably not lawyers who have passed the bar in Connecticut, but have in New York. So pro hac vice is just an administrative thing to get this lawyer permission to practice law to defend their client in this jurisdiction. So we've made it
yes,
boring.
And if we really get into the details, we will learn that this case has already reached such size that we have multiple Jonathan Shapiros.
Yes, we do. We have Jonathan L. Shapiro. Yes, we do.
We don't have to get into all of those details because there's enough here. So we're going to, first of all, let's just start it this way, Brandon, before we kind of get into the details of the statement and we'll get into the specific language. What would you state if someone was to ask you this 29-page filing? What were the major points that were raised from Vince McMahon's side that you would take away and condense for kind of the Cole's Notes version of what this was?
Well, he denies any wrongdoing. He's been accused of sexual assault and sex trafficking. He denies that he mistreated Janelle Grant in any way. He's raising some other issues pertaining to Janelle Grant's claims that she was grieving the loss of her parents and that she had been taking care of her parents intensely. And there's some other things raised in here that are meant to undermine the credibility and question the credibility of Janelle Grant. Mainly, legally, what this is about is the fact that the NDA contained a arbitration clause, which we're going to ask Jason Cruz exactly what arbitration is when he comes and joins us later. But arbitration means that you resolve some dispute that you have in private, not in the public court. And that's the point of what this filing was about, is that this should go to arbitration because that's what the NDA says. Grant has already anticipated and is trying to get this NDA invalidated. This is something that the judge will have to decide eventually about whether or not this is going to go to arbitration or it's going to continue as a public lawsuit.
So I'm going to go through a bit of this preliminary statement because it kind of outlines Vince McMahon's side, which other than the outright denial that we heard right back when the lawsuit was filed, this is the most substantive response we have had from Vince McMahon. And so again, from this filing that came out on Tuesday, by publicly filing her salacious, false, and defamatory complaint, plaintiff has brazenly and intentionally violated a binding contract to arbitrate. The complaint's outrageous claims of sexual abuse and coercion are pure fiction, plainly intended to garner publicity, and are flatly contradicted by the plaintiff's own contemporaneous statements. The plaintiff's false allegations, plaintiff and defendant engaged in a consensual relationship during which the defendant never coerced the plaintiff into doing anything and never mistreated her in any way. In fact, in a love letter that the plaintiff wrote to the defendant shortly before the parties ended their relationship, the plaintiff described the defendant as my best friend, my love, my everything. This being the letter that was leaked to the New York Post that we talked about a couple of weeks back. It is incredulous that the plaintiff, a then 42-year-old woman who claims on her resume to have a law degree from Pace University, would have written these words to the defendant months after all of the events in the complaint of alleged abuse, coercion, and sex trafficking took place. So let's just end it there. And obviously, this is trying to paint this as a consensual relationship. There was no, she was not forced into this relationship. This was something that was completely above board. Now, there's also the line in there about claims to have a law degree from Pace University, which would sound on the surface as trying to discredit her qualifications, which, I mean, do further arise the questions of why she was hired in this role in WWE, if we are taking into account the fact that she may have, at least from this statement, questioning those credentials just on face value.
And that's being referenced as on her resume. So presumably Vince has access or has seen her resume, and she says she has a law degree from Pace University, and she was hired into the legal department. Remember, that was her at least initial position in the company. I did make a call before we went to the air here to Pace University, but it went to voicemail. So we'll try to verify that.
Yes. At the time the parties met in 2019, the plaintiff was not dealing with profound grief from her parents' death and struggling financially as described in her complaint. And she had not been devoting years to around the clock caregiving of her parents. Those statements are complete falsehoods. Based on a foreclosure action against the plaintiff and her parents, the plaintiff's father passed away April the 18th of 2017, 2 years before the plaintiff met the defendant, and his marital status was recorded as widowed, confirming that the plaintiff's mother had passed away earlier. So, I mean, this is something where, okay, this is Vince McMahon's assertion that she was not grieving at this point, but to simply use the timeline, I mean, that it is giving us at least the gap between when they met and when the parents passed away. However, there is obviously, I mean, it's very difficult to pin down when grief ends, and that's obviously a point of contention that Ann Callis had, that we will get to her statement as well, kind of using this grief as though, like, it's been 2 years, get over your parents. What's this is ridiculous that she would still be mourning or dealing with the loss of her parents. But this also brings about the foreclosure issue with the parents' home. And you've had a chance to kind of go through that, because this court document was included in the filing on Tuesday.
It was mentioned, and we found it. So this is a case that was filed with the New York State Supreme Court, which began in 2017, apparently, when a home that belonged to Janelle Grant's father was being foreclosed. Found out as a result of this, and this is what's being mentioned by Vince's lawyers here, they found out this foreclosure case found that that Janelle Grant's father, Anthony, had passed away in April 2017, and they found that the mother had passed away sometime, we don't know when, before that. So both of her parents had passed away by April 2017 is what they're raising as a fact based on the foreclosure lawsuit.
Yeah, and while we have it here, this was a statement that Ann Callis did release to both Brandon and I. Vince McMahon has never known a storyline that he doesn't twist to fit his own shameful narrative. Her father was in in-home hospice during his final days, where Janelle continued to care for him around the clock. Prior to his death, she had been caring for her blind, wheelchair-bound mother. Using the grief of someone who lost both of her parents is an all-new level of disgusting. So that is Ann Callis's response to that portion where they are attempting to discredit this, and then further stating that court records show that contrary to her claim of around-the-clock caregiving, the plaintiff's father lived in a senior care home in Stamford, Connecticut before he passed away, not with her, and the Grant's neighbor would bring plaintiff's mother dinner and help around the house before she passed. In fact, contrary to her story of around-the-clock devotion in the complaint, the foreclosure action on her parents' home reveals that the plaintiff was adamant that she did not want to be associated with, quote, any of this, and failed to respond to requests regarding the foreclosure action.
And that's all based on things that are found in a certain document that's part of the foreclosure litigation. And if we can look at exactly what's in that foreclosure document, we'll put this on the screen, and what's being referred to here. So we might as well just read from this, right? What's happening here is this house is in foreclosure, and the bank or whoever this has been contracted out to is trying to find who's the owner of this. And there's this lengthy process that's gone through that we don't need to get that far into. But what it says is they're trying to find who's the next of kin, right? And a phone number was found for Janelle Grant. They called the phone number. Janelle Grant answered the phone and advised that, yes, the mortgage premises is vacant. The defendant, her mother, Jane Grant, is deceased, and that Anthony Grant currently lives in a senior care home in Stamford, but Janelle Grant refused to provide any information and additionally advised that she did not want to be associated with, quote, any of this, and hung up the phone. So it reads as she didn't want to be associated at least with this foreclosure action that was taking place.
In addition to falsehoods about her own background, plaintiff's complaint is further riddled with fabrications and omissions about her relationship with the defendant. During the party's consensual relationship, plaintiff and defendant knew that the other was also involved in other romantic relationships. The plaintiff's was living in Park Tower, a luxury multi-million dollar building in Stamford, with her longtime fiance, attorney Brian Gonsalves. Since August of 2022, Gonsalves had served as senior vice president and chief privacy officer of Televisa Univision, and Gonsalves previously held positions with MasterCard and Hewlett-Packard. Plaintiff and Gonsalves lived in the same luxury building as the defendant, just four floors below. When the parties began their affair in 2019, plaintiff would often visit the defendant at his condominium at all hours, including at 2:30 a.m., to pursue their affair and then return back to her condominium with Gonsalves the same night. It is nonsensical that the disturbing alleged acts in the complaint included violence, coerced sex, and forcing the plaintiff to be defecated on were taking place before the plaintiff returned to her lawyer fiancé four floors below without incident. Defendant was never contacted by Gonsalves, anyone at the building, the police, any friends or plaintiff or any lawyer or advocate for the plaintiff at any time about the fictitious, extensive, years-long abusive behavior alleged in the complaint. And to that response, Ann Callis had stated that she was not dating at the time. Her ex-boyfriend allowed her to stay in the apartment as she rebuilt her life and resumed post taking care of her parents. She had no job and no other financial support to lean back on. So at least at odds are the status of this relationship at the time and Janelle Grant's financial situation in 2019.
Right. So it's Brian Gonclaves, who is said to be the fiance of Janelle Grant. And purportedly they're living together in this luxury condo that Vince also lives in. They're four floors apart.
And then after 3 years and having decided to return to their partners in January of 2022,
I guess we should mention too, if I can interrupt. So, yep. So this part here, I think it's important to note, right? Defendant was never contacted by Gonclaves, anyone at the building, the police, any friends of plaintiff, any lawyer or advocate for plaintiff at the time. So what Vince and Vince's lawyers are saying is that no one raised any issue to Vince about, you know, this allegedly abusive relationship that was going on. And you can take that for what it's worth and what you think it's worth in terms of when there's abusive relationships happening, do those abusive relationships always get raised at the time that they're happening or not? That's what's being pointed out here, that they weren't, there wasn't any issue raised from Gonclaves, who was supposedly living with her, from the police, the people at the building, friends of the plaintiffs, any lawyers or advocates for Janelle Brandt.
So after 3 years and deciding to return to their partners in January of 2022, plaintiff and defendant agreed to end their consensual affair and separate from each other, with plaintiff leaving the company where they worked, World Wrestling Entertainment, Inc. Plaintiff and defendant entered into a binding contract to memorialize that agreement entitled Confidential Settlement Agreement, General Release and Covenant Not to Sue. Plaintiff initially wanted to include a term in the contract mandating that the defendant could not move out of their shared building, but defendant refused to include that term and did not move out. Plaintiff's contention that that contract between the defendant and WWE on the one hand and plaintiff on the other is not enforceable is utterly meritless. But that is an issue for the arbitrator. In fact, because the parties wish to preserve the confidential and private nature of any disputes under the agreement, they specifically provided in the agreement that disputes would be resolved through arbitration. Plaintiff was represented by a lawyer who negotiated the agreement for her before she executed it.
And that brings to mind, it's interesting that, you know, Vince is alleging that Grant wanted him to agree that he wouldn't move out of the condo, which I don't know what to make of that. It does bring to mind, though. So he says he did move out, and it brings to mind that we do have this article from Connecticut Insider, April 2023, you know, reporting this news that they're selling their Park Tower Stanford condo for nearly $2 million at asking price. So that did occur, according to this report.
Yeah. When the defendant learned that the plaintiff, despite her promises, had violated the agreement by wrongfully disclosing both the existence of the agreement and the relationship, he exercised his contractual right to withhold payment otherwise owed under the agreement. In response, the plaintiff sought to harm him. She intentionally violated the enforceable contract with her salacious, false, and defamatory public filing. However, the FAA and binding United States Supreme Court precedent and plaintiff's own agreement require that if plaintiff wishes to proceed with her fictitious claims, she must do so in arbitration, not in this court, and that this action be stayed pending arbitration. So if we go back to the timeline, it is March 30th of 2022. Thankfully, we have the WrestleNomics timeline of all of these events, which is not a small document to go through. The WWE Board of Directors receives an anonymous email from a person who says they are a friend of a former WWE paralegal, Janelle Grant, disclosing a $3 million NDA that McMahon made with Grant following alleged misconduct by McMahon and WWE head of talent relations, John Laurinaitis. So we can assume that this is McMahon placing this on to Janelle Grant, that this is when the information got out, because the first payment, she did receive $1 million of the $3 million NDA, and they were set up for installments every February the 1st. And it's the next year, February the 1st of 2023, that's the first time we don't get a payment installment where there was a $500,000 spread out over the course of the next 4 years.
Right. So and we have the NDA, and Vince has disclosed his version of the NDA as an exhibit. Vince paid Janelle Grant $1 million in January 2022, and they entered into this agreement with, as you can see on the screen, a schedule for $500,000 payments on each February 1st for the following 4 years. So the $1 million payment was made, and then the year came around, and it was February 1st, and he's supposed to pay, according to this agreement, $500,000. By that time, though, as Johnny just said, by that time, the Wall Street Journal report has come out, which was in June of 2022. So that's, you know, more than 6 months before he's supposed to make this payment. And according to the Wall Street Journal report, a friend of Janelle Grant has emailed the WWE board and said that there's an NDA here and that, you know, she was mistreated. So it would seem that, that's the earliest possible time that Vince could be saying that Grant violated the NDA.
And the opposing argument is that once the payment stopped, the NDA was violated, as well as the trafficking act that Janelle Grant has asserted in her own lawsuit that would nullify this NDA. And therefore, that's part of the contention here, is that if the NDA has been broken, is arbitration the venue for this? Because that would be acknowledging that the NDA was still binding. But obviously, that is the key takeaway of all of this, is Vince McMahon is seeking that particular venue to have this remedied in arbitration rather than in any kind of public forum, such as Janelle Grant is attempting.
Yes. And it sounds like, you know, under the agreement that he could be eligible, or could argue that, you know, let's take McMahon's word for it for a moment, you know, that this NDA was violated, and that it is enforceable, contrary to arguments that Grant's side is making about the Speak Out Act. But let's take it for granted that this NDA is enforceable. According to the NDA, if the NDA is violated, McMahon is entitled to his money back. So that $1 million that he already paid, he could theoretically pursue to regain it, in addition to any attorney's fees the loser of the arbitration is supposed to pay the other's attorney's fees as well.
And then the statement ends with, the defendant does not specifically address the substantive merits of plaintiff's counts asserted against him. For the avoidance of doubt, however, defendant vehemently and categorically denies all allegations of wrongdoing in the complaint, including plaintiff's outrageous claims that the defendant coerced the plaintiff into unwanted sexual acts, sexually assaulted and or battered her, trafficked her, and defecated on her. Those are false statements intended for publicity. When the complaint's allegations are adjudicated in the proper forum, arbitration, witnesses are called to testify under oath, and all communications between the parties, including those authored by the plaintiff, which she intentionally did not share in her complaint, are produced. The allegations and claims will be disproven, and the plaintiff will be exposed for the liar she is. Meanwhile, for the foregoing reasons, and as set forth further below, the defendant's motion should be granted. So a lot to take there in terms of Vince McMahon's addressing. I mean, he is denying all of this, and it brings about a lot of questions. Number one, and I would say that regardless of how graphic some of the details are in the suit, what is tangible in that suit, and therefore to me was the most damning, are still those text messages that, I mean, do, like, on its own be enough of a disqualifier for a lot of people. Those are not addressed in this, nor do those texts necessarily, link it to some of the more heinous things, such as, you know, a rape act allegation that is made in the suit. But that is also to be, you know, people are aware of with the fairly concrete evidence. And there was nothing in this statement that was at all challenging the legitimacy of those text messages either.
Yeah, I'm looking through Grant's original complaint to see if there's, I don't know if we want to put those on the screen at this time, though. But they're pretty explicit text messages describing explicit sex acts. Most memorably, and I don't know if you have others you want to bring up here, but that there is that line where he says, "I'm the one who controls you." And I suppose you could read that, McMahon's side would probably read that as that was just the nature of their sexual relationship, that which was consensual. And Grant's side would probably raise that as this was indicative of the control that he exuded over her, not only in that exchange, but because he had, for one thing, employment control over her. According to Grant, he controlled, her healthcare, and those two things specifically, at least. I would also want to consider, whether. Anyway, did you have other text messages that you wanted to bring up there?
I don't have them handy here. I mean, just in the sense of just looking at the text messages, I think that alone is going to paint Vince McMahon extremely negatively to address those in any way. And that is probably, I guess, let's go in a roundabout way here. If you are Vince McMahon, and let's go with his belief that he has been defamed, that he has been he has lost his role in his company as a result of this, or former company as a result of this, why would Vince McMahon want to pursue this in arbitration, as opposed to, like, there is irrevocable damage that has been done to his reputation from this, would you not want the widest, most public venue to exonerate yourself if you feel you have been wronged here? And that's a question for Vince McMahon and for his lawyers. But I think it's one that the public will also be looking at here. Why does Vince McMahon want this to be tried in such secrecy and at a time when the allegations were so public?
Right. Yeah, that's a question for the lawyers, I guess. And then that's the main thing that we should emphasize is that if this does go to arbitration, there could be a lengthy legal process. There could be depositions, but that would all be in private. None of that would be before the public. And if Vince wants to clear his name and have the public be able to read materials that clear him, if there are materials that will do that, that's not going to happen in arbitration. Arbitration will be a secret and none of us will know about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a subject we brought up as well with a lot of the newer UFC contracts when it comes to disputes, is like going that route of going to arbitration. I mean, it is it's the key part coming out of the statement of what they are seeking. We also got the update this week that you had posted about, Brandon, the updated dates when it comes to responses from the defendants in the case between Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE. And they're somewhat spread out over the next couple of months. And I guess that's sort of, you know, John Laurinaitis is a major one in this, in that what his role is going to be in this, because based on what Edward Brennan, his lawyer, had stated publicly, it certainly leaned you towards the idea that he was not discrediting Janelle Grant's allegations and positioning himself as a victim in all of this as well. So I think that is a key person in all of this that could certainly either back this up or at least lend credence to the allegations beyond just Janelle Grant's.
Right. So for Vince, his answer, and an answer is like a term of art in terms of it's a type of legal filing that we may see later. That's kind of what I wanted to say, I think, when I drifted off there, so that he's not going into each allegation that's made in the Grant complaint. Maybe that's something, maybe Jason could inform us about this. That may be something that may be addressed in the answer, which for Vince is due on May 24th. I want to say, when I've looked at other answers, it's not very informative. It's just sort of an emphatic denial. This did not occur. But so for Vince, that is due on May 24th, which this is not. This is not an answer. This is a memorandum in motion to go to arbitration. For WWE, the answer is due June 1st. And for Laurinaitis, it is due May 14th. And it looks like we also have responses for the motion to compel arbitration due from the Grant side on May 14th. So those are some dates to look forward to. But as if you've been trying to follow me, follow this, it's been a lot of confusion and thinking that originally, you know, it was going to be some 60 days since shortly after this lawsuit was filed. But it's been now almost 3 months since this lawsuit was filed. And now we've got the first lengthy response from McMahon here.
Yeah, I would say that this is, like, we knew that there was going to be a response from Vince McMahon, and I'm sure they have been vigorously preparing this before the release on Tuesday. But I think it does leave a lot of questions. Number one being, I mean, the option of going to arbitration. Is it simply that they are attempting to hold Janelle Grant to the verbiage in the NDA? The other is the fact that, like, how much of Vince McMahon's defense was disclosed to WWE, either in the investigation or in those 48 hours after the filing of the lawsuit and before Vince McMahon's resignation that came down in January as well. It's not as though TKO stuck their neck out to protect Vince McMahon in that. He was, like we have seen, there is a marketing campaign to get away from this man. And what is Vince McMahon's end goal in all of this? Is it simply clearing my name? Because if that would be the case, I don't know. Again, if arbitration is, if you are looking to rehab a very damaged reputation. Arbitration is not the venue for it. And beyond that, are you just looking for a monetary, something monetary to get your $1 million back? I mean, what is your end goal? Like, going so far as to imagine that he's going to turn the clock back and he's going to be in an executive position at TKO. Like, I would say that is an extreme leap for even like the ardent Vince McMahon supporter in this case.
Yeah, I would think maybe the thought process of wanting to go to arbitration versus continuing to fight this in the public would be, are you creating some precedent? We know that there's a number of NDAs that Vince has with various women. Are you creating a precedent that you know, you are willing to litigate this in public as opposed to keeping the other party in the NDA to that agreement?
Well, at this point, we are going to be joined by someone that can give us the legal insight that the show and this audience so craves.
Because half of this document is big time in the weeds legally.
When we get into the legalese, we need someone to translate it to us in plain English. And that's why we bring back Jason Cruz to the show. Jason, how are you today?
Hi, Jason.
I'm doing great. Can you hear me okay, guys?
Hear you well.
Coming in wonderful.
Okay.
I thought that by mid-April, we'd be having you on to go all through the antitrust case and all of the drama associated with that. But man, did those cases end with a whimper.
Well, I'm sure that everybody from the UFC side is thankful that it ended the way it is. And we'll still see how it goes for those fighters, whether or not they agree with what they settled to.
Yes. Well, as fighter Sam Alvey stated, you know, fighters make more than they deserve. So, I mean, there's always that attitude out there. But we have you on here to focus on this statement that came out through Vince McMahon's legal representation, and especially looking at the aspect of choosing to go to arbitration here, which McMahon's side is obviously trying to pivot this case toward. Can you take us a little bit into the details of this strategy and sort of how this works now from this message forward in terms of this NDA and the language as you can best understand it?
Well, you know, usually plaintiffs in these particular cases prefer arbitration. I think the basics as far as how arbitration goes, why do it, is it's less expensive, it's quicker. As we've seen with the UFC antitrust lawsuits, things can go on and on and on. With arbitration, it's a swifter process, less expensive, more secure. It's a private arbitrator. In certain instances, you are able to choose who you are picking as the arbitrator. There are timelines that are much quicker than a court schedule.
And it's not a judge it's not like a typical judge like you'd have in a lawsuit.
You know, no, it can be a retired judge. It can be someone who's gone through the process of training to be an arbitrator. You know, I'll tell you, when I used to litigate a lot, it would be anyone, and basically this is state court, not federal court, but it would be anyone that signs up for the program and takes the classes. And obviously you have to have a requisite amount of time litigating cases, but arbitrators can be a partner in a law firm.
You have to be a lawyer.
Yeah, you have to be a lawyer. You have to be a lawyer. Usually in these particular high profile cases on the federal level, you have retired judges, retired U.S. magistrates, things, guys like this. Again, the parties can decide in certain instances who the arbitrator is, or what you also get is here's a list of five guys, pick two, and then you can whittle it down to whoever it is, the parties can, as far as who they want to have. So there's that aspect of the arbitration advantages. As far as the disadvantages, as I think you guys had talked about earlier before I came on, this is all in private. Nobody can attend in open, and you know, this is not like open court where you could attend and then you could make your own judgments of the testimony.
Pacer, listener, none of that.
What's that? No court listener. No. There will be a court stenographer for the record, but there's nobody that will be there independent that will say, hey, this is what McMahon testified to. This is how Grant testified to. This is how they looked on when they were asked these types of questions. There's nobody like that for these types of arbitration. Also, the one other thing I wanted to point out about arbitration is this is likely binding, meaning that there is really no appeal process. The arbitrator will determine the evidentiary rulings, meaning that, you know, if they want to submit a declaration or some sort of piece of evidence, the arbitrator will determine whether or not it's viable. And there's not really I can appeal to an appellate court, or I can appeal to whatnot. It would, and only in very egregious matters can a party go to a trial court for some sort of relief of arbitration decision.
In the case of Vince McMahon, if he were to prevail in arbitration, is he bound by any kind of gag order in terms of the outcome? Is it at his discretion that he can essentially disclose what happened in arbitration if it would be of value to him to, like, obviously this is somewhat attempting to rehabilitate his image that has been damaged with this lawsuit.
And this is one of the things that why McMahon probably wanted arbitration is he can put out his own version of events. Obviously Grant will dispute it. Like we saw in the preliminary statement of Vince McMahon and his lawyers got to take their shot across the bow at dragging Grant and her fiance and her family through the mud with these inflammatory statements, bringing up a foreclosure action. He can create his own reality as far as how the arbitration went. Now, Grant, of course, through her lawyers, can also create their own, how the hearing went. There will be no real, insider that can really disclose what really happened between the parties. Everybody who's in the room probably will not disclose anything because of the course of it's only attorneys, the arbitrator, and the court stenographer or whatnot, or videographer.
Could they make any documents? I love documents. Could they make any documents public if they wanted to?
Obviously evidentiary purposes, they could like they've done already. They can disclose the NDA. They can disclose text messages like Janelle Grant has. They can disclose emails. I think the interesting thing that will come of this, and I don't know if you touched on this, is what John Laurinaitis's part will be in this arbitration. Will he disclose his own version of events? And if so, whose side will it favor? Will it favor Grant's version of events, or will it favor McMahon's version of events?
And then McMahon is arguing that even Laurinaitis, any allegations against Laurinaitis should be should move to arbitration as well, even though Laurinaitis is not a party to the NDA. WWE is a party to the NDA, who's also being sued here. And Vince, of course, is a party to the NDA, but Laurinaitis is not. And there's an argument in this memorandum that even Laurinaitis, even those issues need to go to arbitration.
You know, that's the interesting legal part there is that, you know, Laurinaitis probably is bound by his employment agreement with WWE, which likely has an arbitration provision in and of itself. So you could say that this is within the gambit of his employment with WWE, and therefore that would have to go to arbitration, whatever disagreement he has or claims he might have or whatever testimony he may provide for McMahon or on behalf of McMahon or against McMahon.
Yeah. And so the reasons why Grant has argued why this NDA shouldn't be enforced include, I think there's four of them, but I remember at least three. It's that, okay, he stopped payment. He's violated the NDA. This agreement was coerced out of Grant allegedly by McMahon. And third, there's new legislation called the Speak Out Act, which is supposed to make NDAs basically, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, not enforceable when it comes to issues regarding sexual harassment or other sexual misconduct.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that McMahon's attorneys did a good job in denying each and every of those allegations. I think one, we get more of a background on Grant, being that she is a law school graduate, she's an intelligent person. She's not someone who is not up to what goes on with contracts and things like that. She also had an opportunity to retain a lawyer to negotiate this NDA. There's that. As far as the Speak Out Act, I think that they had the argument that it was grandfathered. I mean, this occurred prior to the invocation of the Speak Out Act, so they would be they would not be compelled to litigate that in court. And I think
there's another act that was put into law in March. So this agreement was made in January 2022. There's another issue that McMahon's side anticipates potentially being raised by Grant's side, but the Speak Out Act was put into law, I think we have it here, December 2022.
Okay.
So, but the Speak Out Act is retroactive, whereas this other act, I'm sorry, I can't remember what it's called. This other act is not retroactive, which was put into law after this agreement was made. But the Speak Out Act is retroactive, but there's this argument that McMahon's side raises, saying nothing in the text of the Speak Out Act statute, the legislative history, the underlying purpose of the act suggests that congressional intent to also render a related arbitration clause is not enforceable. So what I take that to mean is that, yes, the Speak Out Act pertains to NDAs, but it does not pertain to arbitration clauses.
That is their argument, right? Because it's silent on. So basically, they create the perspective of their argument, and then they tell you that's what it says. So what they're saying is the text of the statute is silent. I think that's what they're really arguing, and therefore, since it's silent, it would also include the fact that this could be argued in an arbitration. I think that's what their article persuasion argument is related to this act. And I think the other act you were talking about was the Trafficking Act.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. And so I think they also address that too in the complaint. I mean, not the complaint, in the motion to compel, stating that can be also decided by the arbitrator. I think what we see here is McMahon's attorneys stating the overall policy here of the FFA, of the Federal Arbitration Act, is that the arbitrator decides everything, whether or not. So what I'm trying to say is, like, if the contract demands arbitration and there's a dispute on it, the arbitrator decides whether it's going to be arbitrated or goes to a trial court. And this morning I was looking at, I think this big instructive, there was a Georgia case in which home remodeling case, construction company, homeowner signs a construction company to do home remodeling. The home remodeling is shoddy. The homeowner sues the contractor. The contractor invokes the arbitration clause. Arbitration clause, the homeowner claims or finds out that the contractor is not a licensed contractor. So argues to the court, hey, this guy cannot enforce the Arbitration Act because he's not a licensed contractor. So that's the contract is therefore voidable or void. Mm-hmm. And so therefore we could sue it in court. The court decides, the district court in Georgia decides that is not the case, that regardless of whether or not the guy was a licensed contractor, it must go to arbitration. So which we're seeing here from McMahon's side is the argument that regardless of whether or not there was a breach, McMahon didn't pay grant the follow-up payments. An arbitrator must decide the case because she knowingly acknowledged that there was a clause where any dispute must go to the arbitrator, and then the arbitrator will make that decision.
So the other act that's referenced here, it says plaintiff may attempt to argue. This is McMahon's side anticipating what they might argue back. Plaintiff may attempt to argue in opposition that the ending forced arbitration of Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act, which was enacted in March of 2022 and renders unenforceable a, quote, pre-dispute arbitration agreement with respect to sexual assault and harassment disputes. The footnote goes on, but that's what they're saying. That's not retroactive, so you can't bring that into play here.
That would be the argument, yes.
Yeah. So it sounding from what you're discussing, Jason, is that this is going to have to go in front of an arbiter to at least determine if this can move to court. Like, it doesn't sound like the plaintiffs have like many options beyond that being kind of the next venue that they do have to go in front of to figure out where this will be tried.
Yeah, I haven't done a ton of legal research on it. So maybe Grant's side can find a couple cases that indicate if there's a breach of the agreement, then it nullifies the arbitration clause in that agreement. However, the overarching argument for arbitration and the policy behind why parties go to arbitration seems to be the prevailing argument here. And therefore, you know, WWE probably will at least get an arbitration hearing to determine whether it should go forward. The substantive elements could go forward.
So is it, you're saying that there's some sort of arbitration decision about whether or not it goes to arbitration, not the judge in this federal case will decide that.
Correct. So what happens is motion to compel, Grant's side gets an opportunity to oppose the motion. Then there is a reply brief by WWE or at McMahon's side, by McMahon's side. And then at that point, the court will decide whether it goes to arbitration or retain it. The judge will likely send it to arbitration. At that point, Grant's side, I believe, will have the opportunity to argue, no, arbitrator, this has to go back to the court because X, Y, and Z, you know, McMahon didn't pay, here's cases, blah, blah, blah. And then the arbitrator can decide, because it will be his jurisdiction, right, at that point, he or she can decide whether or not they can retain the case, or if the case, you know, if Grant's argument was compelling, or if the case should go back to the trial court judge. Obviously, there's a lot of other appeals at that point. If Grant wins that particular argument as to what kind of appeal WWE has, do they have an appeal with the arbitrator? Do they have an appeal with the court? What's said? But I think that Grant has a slim chance of not seeing an arbitrator in this particular case.
If given the okay for the defendants to take this to arbitration, do you think that at all decreases the chances of the defendants coming to the plaintiffs and trying to just work out a settlement? Do you think that would affect that they would, if they get the go ahead for arbitration, they would rather go that path than to just give a lump sum and make this go away?
I think so. I think that what was it, footnote 5, where McMahon's attorneys say, you know, if she thinks that this agreement is null and void, then we want our $1 million back. So, you know, there's some pressure points here from McMahon's attorneys where they can, you know, say, you know, take a settlement or else we'll seek to recoup this money, or we'll make it tough, that sort of thing. So, yes, I think that McMahon, assuming that the trial court allows this case to go to arbitration, he has the higher up, better position to leverage whatever he wants to do, whether he wants to go through the arbitration or whether he is willing to settle for a lower amount than what the NDA had.
So I'm just a dumb reporter here. So
that's okay. No, me too.
You think it's likely then that the judge will say, yes, to some extent, this has to go to arbitration. And then the arbiter will decide how far into arbitration it will go before it might bounce back to federal court?
No. Good question, though. So the trial court does have the jurisdiction at that point to say, hey, okay, does this go to arbitration or not? And then, like I said, yes, it'll probably go to arbitration. So he throws the jurisdiction ball to the arbitrator. The arbitrator then has the jurisdiction. Grant probably will say, first off, hey, Mr. Arbitrator or Miss Arbitrator, you can't decide the substantive points of this case because X, Y, or Z. And then the arbitrator has the jurisdiction and legal authority to decide, you're right, we'll throw it back, or no, I have the authority based on the Federal Arbitration Act, and this case will go forward under arbitration.
One other aspect I'm just curious about, and again, it's trying to get into the head of Vince McMahon about what his ultimate goal is here. But I mean, if he were to whether this had gone to court or arbitration, and there's a ruling in his favor that discredits Janelle Grant's allegations, like, what is at Vince McMahon's legal disposal in terms of going to TKO and stating, hey, I was not in due process. I was forced to resign against my will, and I was wrongfully dismissed from my very lucrative position in this company.
You know, interesting, right? Because the problem is, or the issue is, he's sold off so much stock. So it's not like,
that he voluntarily sold, yes.
Yeah, that he voluntarily sold stock. So it's not like he wanted to stay on, and somehow he might ask if he can have some sort of role with TKO. Of course, there is the outlying issues, like, what about the other women and other payoffs? You know, TKO is doing so well with their new, you know, a new regime.
It's a new era.
Yeah, it's a new era. What would they benefit? What would TKO benefit having McMahon come out and come back in some sort of emeritus role? I mean, you know, we got the NBC News article that he's adopting cats and,
yes,
you know, you're doing going on walks. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, it would be hard for him to make an about face. It wouldn't be out of the possibility. Obviously, we all know Vince McMahon. He's not going to do any other like organization or show up on AEW television. But obviously, there's a little bit of
a non-compete of 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Then get ready. Saudi Arabia Federation, it's coming.
Right, right. But it would be hard for me to see him going back to TKO and saying, I want back in. Not out of the question, obviously never out of the question with Vince McMahon, but it would be kind of hard pressed, especially with him liquidating a lot of that stock. Hard for anybody within TKO to say, come back in.
Before I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, Jason, and I understand if maybe you haven't had a chance to go through this yet, but the FTC has made this ruling about non-compete clauses, and I'm just curious if you've had a chance to look over any of it, and do you see any specific effects, whether it be to pro wrestling or mixed martial arts, that we should be kind of keeping our eyes on?
Yeah, you know, it's a big thing. I haven't really looked over it a lot. However, you know, obviously the big thing goes to executives over a certain amount. Those non-competes still pertain to them. I actually had emailed that FTC letter to a couple of clients because of non-compete issues. But there's two big things to think about here. So if you're a UFC fighter, do you challenge that? Do you say, you know, this in my contract, I can now go to PFL or wherever? Or if you're a WWE wrestler, or maybe if you're an AEW wrestler and you have a non-compete, you know, can you show up on WWE television? Well, WWE television allow you to show up.
This would apply apparently to independent contractors, not just employees, which is all the wrestlers and I think the fighters too, right?
Right. It applies to them. So how restrictive, ability does a promotion or a company have to retain an independent contractor at this particular point when the FTC says you don't have non-competes anymore? It'll be interesting to see if anyone challenges it. I think there still is the factor of, you know, goodwill and wanting to be good in the eyes of a good employee or independent contractor in the eyes of a promoter. Do you want to be that first guy to, or guy or gal to ruffle waves? I mean, honestly, if from the AEW perspective, could a wrestler show up on MLW or a WWE NXT or something like that? Would WWE NXT allow that? That sort of thing would be interesting to come
going forward. If Trevor Lee, who was just released, was to show up on AEW TV tonight, that might lead to a lawsuit that would test whether or not this applies.
Right. Although I would think that the new era, NXT, this is part of the future endeavors of the WWE, and that they'll allow Trevor Lee to show up on AEW television. I mean, that is very correct. I don't know if there's a 90-day sit out.
We assume there's a 90-day non-compete.
Yeah, unless,
they are paid for those 90 days.
Yeah, see, the thing is, if he's being compensated, you know, it's hard for, you know, what are the damages then? Because he's being compensated. He's not, they just don't tell him to stay out for 90 days and we don't pay you.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for educating us on arbitration. I know that when everyone woke up this morning, that was what they knew. I'm going to dive into the whole education of arbitration. And maybe next time we have you on, we can get into AI-generated rap lyrics being used in diss tracks, and because we're going into a whole new frontier now when it comes to these kinds of cases.
I'm waiting for the promos, the AI promos from guys from yesteryear to come back on wrestling.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. And let people know as well where all of your work can be found and keeping up to date on this case and other ones.
Oh, yeah. MMAPayout.com. And thanks again for having me.
All right. Thanks so much, Jason. We appreciate it.
All right. Great. Have a great day.
All right. That was Jason Cruz joining us. And are you more or less confused after the Vince McMahon side put out this filing on Tuesday, Brandon? Because certainly adds to kind of just the different directions that this can go, but it does definitely give us a bit of insight into what they are attempting, with arbitration being their destination point.
Well, what I'm going to do later, as all listeners of this program do, I'm going to re-listen to this, and then we'll see if it soaks further into my brain, just what's going to happen next with this lawsuit. But it sounds like there'll be some arbitration. I guess there'll be some sort of judgment, at least. Now, I'll listen to it later. I'll figure it out.
Yes. Maybe by next week's show, we can talk a bit more about these non-competes, because this only came out on later in the day on Tuesday, and this kind of coincided with the whole Vince McMahon story. I would like to look into this more and see what, if any, impact it does have with regards, especially to professional wrestling. But it is very interesting. Could Vince McMahon be out of his no-compete? Could he start by instantly?
Well, if this doesn't apply to executives of a certain level, then I would imagine he clears that bar, but who knows?
Well, let's touch on a couple of other news items as well that were coming down. So this ended up being, by coincidence, we had Karen Peterson on last week, and we were discussing the launch of Marigold. Julia informed us. And in that discussion with Karen that you can go back and listen to from last week, we did get into this discussion point, because Yuzuki had put out at the press conference the note that Marigold is looking for women unmarried between the ages of 13 and 30, I believe was the gap. And this did generate, especially from the Western audience, a lot of pushback, a lot of concern about that this did not really, it raised eyebrows. And, you know, Karen was talking with us about, you know, the fact that a lot of the like Joshi scene, it is kind of predicated on the idol culture. And this sort of took on another wave when Kenny Omega, via his Twitch stream, where he seems to just go live and it's no holds barred. And Kenny Omega,
Michael Nakazawa in the background, of course.
Yes, with Michael Nakazawa as these guys. I understand that they were playing Street Fighter of some sort. So a lot of guile here shown by Omega. He has asked a question about Rossi Ogawa, and I'm just going to read a portion of what he said in his words, and said, "If you are still interested in wrestling and you are kind of still listening to the stories and reading stuff when it finally comes out, there are a lot of people who refuse to work with him, meaning Rossi Ogawa, for the very same reasons. Some of those people are even in WWE. Some of those people are in AEW. They have a very good reason. It's not just, I decided to wake up and not like this guy. If you want to know along what lines he's tread amongst that, the dude just flat out said, hey, we are looking for girls ages 13 to 21 who don't have a boyfriend and aren't married. We already know he puts underage girls in swimsuit calendars and books. I wish that is all he did. Let's put it that way." So that is kind of the significant portion, which is, you know, a pretty sizable accusation to be making. Omega did state he didn't have any firsthand evidence, but, you know, among whispers that he has heard, that is, you know, the allegation that he made here. You know, it's very hard to go off of something that he's not specifically calling out what it is he is accusing Rossi Ogawa of, but also not leaving too much wiggle room of what people are going to conclude based off of a statement like that. You know, this is something that Karen spoke about last week in the interview, the fact about having like girls in some of these like swimsuit photo shoots, that again, it's an aspect of Japanese wrestling and of idol culture that I think is going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. And I don't think that means it's just something that you just explain as, well, it's a different culture and you can't question it. But it was,
I believe he alluded to people in government would know something about what he was talking about. I think that's part of what he said. And if there's any way to look into this, and I know we're crossing a language barrier, but you know, if there's any way we could look into that, you know, we would want to, if there's any opportunity to do so.
Yeah. I mean, this got obviously a lot of attention because of who stated it in reference to Kenny Omega. So I don't know how much more this will be addressed, but I would think if you are Rossi Ogawa, you would want to make it very clear to that English speaking audience of denying if you are being alleged of something that you have not committed, or you just do not address it at all. But this was a pretty significant story over the weekend that we did want to cover, because it really did dovetail off our conversation we had with Karen last week. Staying in Japan, a story that came out earlier this week is that New Japan announced that it has fully acquired the stakes of Bushiroad Fight Limited from its parent company, Bushiroad. And with the acquisition, Bushiroad Fight will become a fully owned subsidiary of New Japan Pro Wrestling effective June the 28th. And they stated that the goal of this acquisition is to improve operating efficiency and reduce redundancies within Bushiroad's sports unit. Reed,
I love it when redundancies are reduced.
Yes. We need to reduce redundancies. So, I mean, this certainly feels like a lowering of a headcount when it comes to the Bushiroad Fight sector of Bushiroad. But more importantly, it kind of gives you this vertical that is now going to be New Japan overseeing what is largely Stardom, and what that means for Stardom, and what that means for kind of having more of an in sync product with the two companies as well, as opposed to kind of separate operations underneath that Bushiroad Fight banner.
I mean, there was this tweet from Chris Charlton who said, "While this isn't a front of house affecting situation, it is great news for fans indirectly. Operational efficiency means no tripping over one another with big events on the same day, better / more effective cross promotion, and better ways for the whole family to experience pro wrestling." I think of the point that Wei has made recently about how it's surprising that, you know, you look at Wrestle Universe and all the different promotions that are on there under the Cyber Fight banner, and you've got, you know, two completely separated streaming services in the case of NJPW World and Stardom World. Maybe those could be on the same service.
Yeah.
Not that there's any hint to that here, but that's a thought.
No. And I think that would certainly be a fan friendly move to put all of them under the New Japan World banner. But yeah, that's not even hinted at. And I mean, you would have to imagine like New Japan World is not like a major service. Stardom World would be a niche of that niche on top of it. Like, would you necessarily expand your numbers by just putting it into one versus having the two separate services as is? But I think at least for if your goal is to have kind of more of a synchronicity between the two brands, I think bringing them all there, I think that would only enhance your Stardom viewership on top of it.
Yes.
Other notes. This was mentioned by actor David Spade. This kind of went unchecked during the week, but David Spade was at UFC 300 and took a photo and noted that their cage side, were you aware, Ted Sarandos was there. I think he was in Donald Trump's former seat. Donald Trump didn't make it to UFC 300, so it led Ted Sarandos to get a cage side seat for UFC 300. I know he's a big Max Holloway fan, and I'm sure he was there just talking about the merits of the BMF title and, you know, his thoughts just on the the current UFC strawweight scene and who is Bilal Muhammad going to get that welterweight title fight this year. So I can't imagine what else Ted Sarandos would be there discussing, but I've never seen him at a UFC event before. So taking in his first card just happens to be a year when UFC's rights will be up next year, at the end of next year.
Ted was blocking David Spade's view, apparently. That's why we have a picture here of, I think that's Ted Sarandos' head. That's what I imagine Ted Sarandos looks like from the back. So the ESPN Plus rights. There could be some interest from Netflix. Imagine having both the WWE rights currently held by Peacock and the UFC rights currently held by ESPN Plus under one Netflix streaming service. I'm sure they would be interested in having those conversations.
So I am here to make a big proclamation, and I'm going to give my co-host Brandon Thurston the credit or the blame, who started this ball rolling on an AEW conference call months ago. But I am now convinced. A 3-hour AEW block is coming, and it was solidified for me on this past Saturday night when up against the NBA playoffs, up against the NHL playoffs, Collision pretty much flat from the week prior, but Rampage just an enormous bump, a 65% jump in their among their core 18 to 49 audience from the prior Friday. I think this is just inevitable. Whether it's a Wednesday night 3-hour block, whether it's a Saturday block, I think it's coming, and I think we should all mentally prepare now that when the announcement comes that AEW is going to have a 3-hour block, everyone needs to just start accepting it now, because I feel it's coming. That's my bold prediction I'm making. And Brandon, you were the first one to float this to Tony Khan on a press conference, and I think it's going to happen.
You thought you were going to get out of covering AEW Rampage and it was becoming a superfluous extra hour of wrestling. Oh, no. Oh, no. The best way to get the best viewership out of Rampage is to stack it on top of 2 hours of Dynamite. Probably Dynamite would be the best because it's the biggest rocket ship underneath, right? But even Collision, when you stack Rampage on top of Collision, you still end up with the best Rampage rating compared to anything in its natural time slot in at least a couple months here. So it's a better way to get a better rating out of Rampage, you know, as opposed to, I mean, think about it. If you're going to air Rampage, especially at 10 o'clock at night, what's going to be a better lead-in, Transformers or AEW content?
Not to mention, in both women 18 to 49 and the 18 to 34 demo, they grew the audience for Rampage for that third hour as opposed to leveling off. So, I mean, even in some specific categories, you got an increase in that third hour. So, again, it's kind of just been these one-offs. Well, we should say they are doing this again this coming Saturday. But I think it's very clear that Rampage following one of your other programs is the best placement for Rampage. And you're right, Dynamite would be the most significant one to follow for obvious reasons. But it to me makes a whole lot more sense. And spreading out your programming on two nights as opposed to three nights, I think has its own advantages to it as well. But it's just from everything of what they are aiming for, I just think that it's it just seems to make so much more sense. And when I saw these numbers, it kind of just I arrived at that conclusion, and I mentally told myself, get ready for 3 hours of AEW. It's coming.
Yeah. I was talking through it on the Sunday show. Well, I guess it was the Monday show this week about the idea that I don't know what will happen in terms of, do they just lengthen? We're taking for granted now that all this is going to happen, but do they just lengthen Dynamite into 3 hours? Does Rampage go away, or is Rampage an established enough brand that that is something that you continue to shop, whether it's to WBD or whether to another media partner?
Also, the Raw number on Monday night, they did 1,597,000 viewers and a 0.52 in the 18 to 49 demographic. So their lowest since January when they were going up against NFL playoff competition, but still beating everything except for the NBA on Monday night, a 12% drop in viewership from the week before, 15% drop in the 18 to 49 demographic. But I mean, it started off at like 1.6 million viewers. If you want to look at a silver lining, yes, it was a lower amount of people tuning in, but it's not like they had like appreciable drop off. Like the people that tuned in, like they stuck around for the show on Monday night. How did you look at this number now that they are fully into playoff season?
I don't look at it as you know, the sky falling. This was the lowest rating in months, I understand.
Is the new era done, Brandon? Is it over?
The new era is over. Get your Paul Levesque, unflattering pictures ready. Look at year over year. They are still doing well. This is the playoffs, so we'll have some excuses here for the next few weeks as the NBA playoffs continue. But, you know, it's not that big of a deal yet. It's just one data point. But if it continues, then we'll discuss whether it's the end of an era.
Let's finish off with one final story here, and that is going back to Sunday Dynasty. We got some figures, courtesy of our good pals at Polestar. What can you tell us, Brandon, about how the show performed in St. Louis, Missouri?
Exclusive news here. I mean, you're not going to find this anywhere else. I'm serious. Breaking. Unless you've got a Polestar subscription like we do, we can tell you what the gate was for Dynasty in St. Louis at the how do you say this? Chevets.
Chaffetz is what Chaffetz. I'm going with.
Chaffetz Arena. 6,287 tickets sold, which aligns well with the estimated tickets distributed from WrestleTix, which I read earlier today was a little bit higher than this number, and a gate of about $400,000, $401,373, an average ticket price of $64. So that would be the lowest gate for a pay-per-view for AEW that I'm aware of, but this was one of these new pay-per-views that they've just sort of popped up. And that's what it did. 400,000. I think the Wrestle Dream gate, I don't have it on me, but the Wrestle Dream gate.
This is WrestleGate will be another spinoff pay-per-view.
That's a Dragon Gate show. Yeah. I think Wrestle Dream did around $600,000 without looking it up. So this was lower than that. For whatever that's worth, we'll see what we hear about what it did in terms of pay-per-view buys, which I have no data on that.
Yes. The WrestleTix number was just over 6,600, but that is that includes comps and, you know, adds up pretty well to this ticket sold number. And if we're looking ahead, because AEW is back in only a couple of weeks with their next show, the Double or Nothing show, which is just over 5,400 tickets out so far at the MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. So still plenty of tickets to move for their return to Vegas, which they are doing back-to-back nights at the MGM Grand with Collision the night prior. And then the Sunday night is the pay-per-view, which is also coincides with a Saudi Arabia event with WWE that weekend.
That's right. Wrestle Dream Gate, just over $500,000, $534,000 for Wrestle Dream, according to Polestar from an earlier report we had here.
Yes. What do you think the gate is going to be for NXT Battleground at the UFC Apex?
What do they call it? On location? The Endeavor subsidy on location? I'm sure they'll generate.
I think like the price per ticket is going to be something nuts. I think that's what they're going to scale this for.
Dozens of thousands of dollars. What do you think the atmosphere is going to be like at the UFC Apex for this show?
It is such a complaint when it comes to these UFC fight night cards, the atmosphere. And this is for like fights where, not to say like the atmosphere is the like purpose of a, like to make or break a fight card, but for a wrestling show, like it has a huge impact. And I'm just curious.
I mean, this is a brand that usually runs in the performance center in front of a similar number of people, I guess.
It does. I'm just like, do you even have like your hardcores that are going to attend this, especially if it's some like upscale price for this like intimate environment that, that you're going to have? Like, I don't assume that Mark Zuckerberg is going to be renting this out to just watch a card as he did for a fight night last year. But
and was that know. In the Apex? Zuckerberg
that
went
was,
to the Apex.
That was at the Apex. Yes.
Yeah.
We'll have to maybe see, Dana White attends. Maybe Dana White attends his first NXT show.
Rick Rubin is a wrestling fan. What are some other Mark Cuban? Maybe you could invite.
Sure. Yeah. Mark Ratner. Yeah.
This is a branding opportunity in terms of, can you make this a very exclusive experience and create the impression of scarcity and exclusivity and high rollers here? Sort of like PWG was, you know, I was just looking too, by the way, PWG has not like run a show in 2024 and they've, you know, maybe they're only rolling bull anymore. In any case, there's an opportunity here to get rich and famous people to show up here for NXT Battleground. For the, you know, a really high end, you know, people with real taste, they enjoy NXT Battleground.
That's it. If we get Mark Zuckerberg yelling "Whoop that trick" on Battleground, I guess it's worth the upheaval of getting all your talent over to Vegas for that particular weekend.
Yeah.
But that's going to bring you up to date on all the latest news that is going on, and probably more to come in the ongoing Janelle Grant lawsuit and responses to come in the coming weeks from other defendants in the case. And we will see how this all shakes out and arbitration. Will we see a mysterious janitor in the corner with a WrestleNomics hoodie that is just trying to eavesdrop on this arbitration hearing?
Maybe. And I was trying to ask you before we went to air, you've completed your reading of Burn Book. Is that true?
I did. Yes, it turned out when we were in Philadelphia, Brandon mentioned that you were reading Burn Book, and I was literally reading it at the same time. Like, our brains are just...
I listened to the audiobook, let's be fair here.
Oh, okay. I did physically read this book on my Kindle. No, Kara Swisher is a great reporter, and this was her going through her decades of reporting on the tech industry, and as well kind of this interesting amalgamation that she has gone through that I think lots of people can learn from in terms of this modern day of reporting / journalism, is kind of mining the space of both a reporter and running your own business, that doing a lot of these, you know, tech events before they were like commonplace that you see so often now. It's sort of this idea of creating a brand for yourself and be able to sell yourself, which, I am terrible at. So I cannot relate in that sense. But nonetheless, I think it's like she is someone that's...
you guys have run a successful business here. I thought the chapter called Pivoting towards the end was very instructive in terms of talking through some of her reporting experiences, which sounded all too familiar to me.
Yes. Yeah. Mysterious calls and off the record. Yes. All the... All the fun verbiage that you get on a routine basis. But there you go. I recommend the book. I think it's good. Actually, I'm reading one that you would be interested in. It's called Rogers versus Rogers, about the media giant here in Canada. This is essentially a country built on Rogers and Bell. They are two competing telecommunications, companies, and giant internal battle, different class structured shares, inner family turmoil, fighting over the company, stuff that you would never be able to extrapolate to other areas.
Did you have coverage. the Adelphia cable people? Was that only on my side of the border?
I did not have to deal with that.
Okay.
No.
Somebody went to jail from Adelphia cable back in my formative years.
Oh, okay. Can't say I was part of that.
Okay.
But there you have it, everyone. Thank you to Jason Cruz for stopping by as well. And of course, you can go check out postwrestling.com. Join the Post Wrestling Cafe. If you want something that's totally different from today's show, Wei Ting and I are going to be reviewing on the Cafe Thursday a Hustle event from May of 2004 that, I'm not kidding, was headlined by Shinya Hashimoto and Naoya Ogawa against Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. Toshiaki Kawada against Mick Foley. Mick Foley inheriting Bill Goldberg's giant payday because Goldberg was too hurt to go over to Japan. Mark Coleman wrestling on this card. Pretty much imagine millions put onto a bonfire and just lit on fire. That was the scene at the Yokohama Arena. Yes.
Yes.
Tons of money and very few people showing up for these shows.
If you ever want to see a match that is like obviously called in the ring between two people who do not speak, literally do not speak the same language, watch that Mick Foley versus Toshiaki Kawada match, which I was like, as like a fan of both growing up, I was like, whoa, Foley and Kawada had a match, and I watched and I was like, they're just doing moves to each other here. Okay.
Yeah. It was, I think Mick Foley had about a couple of days notice that he was going to be getting. So even for this giant payday, it was like a 6-figure deal he gets for this. It's not like they even had time to promote this thing. It's just like, what a promotion hustle. So that's coming up on Thursday. And then you're back to Sunday this coming weekend.
Probably. Yeah.
Probably. Follow WrestleNomics.com. And in the show description, I've included the link to Brandon's timeline that everyone should be going through. I do it on a bi-daily basis to keep everything straight, this essential timeline as well. We also have the link to the entire statement from Vince McMahon and all the latest that you can follow on from that 29-page filing. But that let's make sure we didn't get it. Oh, we do have a super chat. So let's take one question before we bid everyone a farewell. And it comes from Nicholas, and I didn't pre-read this. With the banning of non-compete clauses, could this mean that this is 1 year non-compete would not be enforced?
I'll have to consult the law. Like we said earlier, I think he may be a high enough level executive that it will not apply, that this new ruling will not apply to him, and therefore he would have to wait 12 months to start his Saudi Arabian professional wrestling organization.
Yes. I mean,
or same go time, all elite, whichever.
Yeah. All possible. The Saudi Arabian Wrestling Federation. I mean, you can't discount any ideas out there. Okay. That's it for us. Thank you for tuning into Pollock and Thurston, and we'll speak with you same time, same channels next week. Goodbye.